host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDOcast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me in studio, sticking around after his show, is my pal Thomas Drance. Thomas, what's going on?
Thrilled to be here. Always happy to join you, Dim. By the way, the contrast between your intro music, which is so chill, and mine, which absolutely is anxiety-inducing on the Canucks Hour, couldn't be sharper. I love it.
What's Canucks Hour? I thought it was called Canucks Talk.
Oh, Canucks Talk.
Yeah,
you're right.
There we go. There we go.
Killing my self-promotion game.
Well, we both had a busy week. You had a busy day doing a lot of content. So we're going to ease into the weekend by having a little fun here.
Sounds good.
We're doing mailbag questions. I've done it a couple weeks so far now, and it's generally a good time. Get that listener engagement going. And honestly, the listeners, the PDOcast listeners always come through. They always come through with the juicy topics.
Do you open it up to the 650 Dunbar Lumber inbox as well?
I think we should.
Yeah.
And do you want to keep an eye on that? And then if interesting topics come in throughout.
And this is all NHL, guys. Not just... Yeah, Brock certainly. Besser takes.
Certainly not. Yeah. In fact, we'd encourage more NHL-centric topics. You can also, in the future, DM it to me, at Dim Filipovich, or email it to me. My email is in my Twitter bio as well for future mailbag editions. The more, the merrier. So, Tom, let's get into it. I've got a couple of my favorite ones here written down. Let's start with a particularly meaty one that I think we could probably do a full segment on here.
Okay.
19 open tabs on Twitter asks.
I'm 19 open tabs, man. I'm
at least at all times.
Yeah.
Would the gold plan drafting system be better than the current lottery system? And do you think it could be realistically implemented in the NHL? And how would that come about? Do you want to give the listeners a quick sort of synopsis of what the gold plan is? And then we can go from there.
Yeah. So my understanding of the gold plan is that from the day you're eliminated, right, you begin to amass points, which will then be used to determine whether or not you are going to own the first overall pick.
Yes.
At the ensuing draft. So effectively, this is a system that incentivizes or rewards the worst teams in hockey by giving them a head start at the ability to amass points. But they still have to win games at the end of the year in order to qualify for the substantial reward that picking first overall at the NHL entry draft is year over year. I'm a huge fan of gold drafting.
Yes.
Big fan. I mean, here's my thing. When the pandemic hit and the NHL had to end a season with an unequal number of games played, teams had played between 68 and 71, NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly sent a memo to all 31 at the time teams explaining the rationale for the play-in tournament, what became the play-in tournament, ultimately passed with the PA's consent as part of an omnibus sort of agreement to both extend the CBA and play, you know, effectively like a 24 team modified playoff bracket in two hermetically sealed bubbles in Canada. And
one which featured you.
One of which I spent a bunch of time at typing out all the swears on my Twitter account, which everyone liked, by the way. I never got any negative feedback from anyone about having done so. So anyway, in that memo that Bill Daly sent, he noted something fascinating and that I think just says everything. He noted that, in fact, with 83% of the NHL season having been played up to the date of cancellation, which was March 12th, 2019 or 2020, excuse me. The standings at that point were actually in some ways more reflective of the true talent level of every team, because in the last 17% of the season, you tend to get teams playing young players and signing free agents, college free agents.
Yeah, playing out the string.
And, you know, you go through the trade deadline. It basically, where they were then said more about true talent than where they would be after 82 games. Well, that's a stunning admission for me, particularly because if you're a customer of any NHL team, if you're a season ticket holder, the league knows that the last 17% of the season isn't like true hockey.
Yeah.
You're just killing time waiting for the playoffs. If you're a general fan of the league, you're just killing time waiting for the playoffs. If you're the fan of a bad team, you're rooting against your team. You're rooting against your team. You're tuning in to watch the Canucks if you're listening to us in Vancouver, or the Flames. I know you guys haven't done this in a while. But you're tuning in and you're rooting against them winning, with sort of the name Connor Bedard on your lips. You're, you know, hosted by our own Petard for Connor Bedard, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, whatever sort of saying is in vogue that season. That's what you're hoping for. You're hoping for failure. And that's a ridiculous way to set up the incentives in a sport. The thing about gold drafting is you still reward the teams that are worse in the league, but you fix this 17% issue. You get to a point where teams have to try and win, even when they're eliminated, because ultimately we know what impact a first overall pick can have in changing, you know, not just a franchise's fortunes on the ice, but frankly, like their valuation off of it.
Yep.
Right? Like Connor McDavid's worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the Edmonton Oilers. Just alone. Connor Bedard's going to be the same. Like, why do you get to back into that? Why do you get to lose into that? Why is failure rewarded there?
Yeah, if you're a fan of a bad team, realistically, the only thing in that back half of the season you have to look forward to is, like, those final 8 or 9 games where your top prospect might get called up, especially if, like, their college season ended or something, to play without burning the first year off their entry-level deal, right? I think I have no issue with tanking in the current system because you're incentivized to do so, even if it doesn't guarantee you the first overall pick. Mm-hmm. Like right now, right, upon the latest lottery system, I think if you finish with the worst record, you're guaranteed a top 3 pick. It used to be top 4, right?
Yeah, which I also don't like.
Right, but I'm just saying for right now, let's play this out.
Yeah.
In the current system, do we agree, like, some people are, like, morally opposed to tanking? I think it's smart business. If you're going to be bad, you may as well be the worst, I think.
Agreed.
Right?
The place you don't want to be is in the middle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, now, I completely get that losing on purpose fundamentally it goes sucks. Against the spirit of competition,
yeah.
Which is what pro sports are.
I hate it. I'm probably the biggest advocate locally in Vancouver for tanking, and yet I hate it. I despise it. Everything about it.
Here's what I'll say, though. I really like, maybe this might be a bad example right now because you look at the state of the Arizona Coyotes, like you look at...
Yeah, it's grim.
The shell roster they have, and it's like, This is, you know, it's clear what
Josh
they're doing.
Josh Brown, top yes. pair defenseman.
I think if you are a smart organization and you utilize the lottery system that's in place right now and the perks of picking high, you will realistically only be there for like 3 years.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Right? And I have no issue with the idea that the league always, to function, needs bad teams.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, it loves to talk up this idea of parity, right? Like, the NHL, anyone can win. Like, oh, look at all
sorry,
this.
Sorry, the official term, I believe, is anything can happen.
Yeah, anything can happen, of course. except for, like, out of 5 teams winning every year.
Well, except anything doesn't, right?
Yes.
The NBA has had more unique champions since 2016 than the NHL has. And the NBA also had 4 straight finals with the 2 same teams.
Yeah.
Like, it's wild how consistently... The best teams are the best teams in hockey.
Also, I don't want 32 evenly matched teams.
No.
I'm fine with having 4 or 5 really bad ones and 4 or 5 exceptionally good ones, and then a bunch of teams in the middle that could conceivably go in either direction.
Well, you're also never going to change that. Like, that's because players gravitate to playing on the best teams, right? There is a reward to being good that's pretty sticky. Just like there is a penalty to being bad that is pretty sticky. Yep. It's tough to become a destination team when you've repeatedly failed for 4 or 5 years. You know, it doesn't change overnight.
Yep.
And so, you know, it is difficult to move up or down. And I also think in the flat cap era in particular, we've sort of had this parity busting paradigm in the sport as a result of, you know, increasingly, if you sort the NHL teams by point percentage, you will see at the top the smartest ones, right? Like
right.
The combination of brain power and an understanding, like raw intellectual horsepower connected to front office operations in combination with the flat cap has really created, I think, a world where the card counters are beating up on whales pretty significantly.
And by that specifically, we should say the teams who invest the most resources off of the ice.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I like the goal plan. And one of the main pushbacks to it is like, well, because you get the high, the more points you get basically after you're eliminated, the higher you pick, right?
Right.
And then it's like, oh, well, if you're a bad team, you're not going to get a lot of points. It's like, well, if you're a really bad team, you're actually going to be eliminated much sooner than the okay teams.
Sure.
And so you actually will have a lot, much more runway to accumulate points. So I think in reality, you probably would actually wind up seeing bad teams pick higher.
Right.
While doing so in like a way where they're actually trying to field the best lineup they can.
Well, people also say things like, well, the deadline is, you're going to make the deadline boring.
Deadline's always boring.
Deadline's always boring, yeah. A. But also B, why wouldn't you see a team sell early to get to the thing as quickly? Like, ideally, you sell early, you get eliminated just before the deadline, or you're close to elimination.
And then you use the deadline as a buyer.
And then you don't necessarily buy all out. Right. What you do is you're like a cap clearinghouse. Yeah. Like, oh, you don't like that totally useful middle six forward who's a little overpaid? Perfect. He's perfect for me. He'll help me win, you know, an extra half game over the balance of the season. Like, I mean, I actually think you'd create interesting opportunities for smart teams within the gold system. And again, the main thing I like about it is it's for the fans. It's for the fans. If you're paying full price for an NHL ticket, you should. If you're tuning in to watch a game, right, and watch the advertisement that comes with the game, even if it's moving on the boards, you deserve to have the reward of not having to watch that game and rooting against your team. You should never be in the seats, whether it's your couch or in the arena, rooting against your team. Ever. Ever. I think that's a very basic principle that the league needs to figure out how to accomplish, in my view. Particularly yeah. because in their own admission, the last 17% of the season barely matters.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the one point that I was going to make was I think the idea of us needing to institute a new system because tanking is running so rampant and ruining the league is a bit overblown. Like, there's been a couple like extreme examples, but you look throughout the league. First off, there's a lot of teams that would do really well to tank.
Yeah, and
that are scared to do so, mm-hmm. Misguidedly, in my opinion. And so they're like, oh, let's try to be okay so we can sell tickets. And in reality, their fans the entire time are like, can we please have a plan instead of trying to sell tickets? That should not be our organization's plan.
Are you talking about anyone in particular?
No, it could be any market, of course. So I would say that the number of teams who actually take advantage of the current system is very minimal. So I don't think it's like that big of an issue. I think it's actually a tired take to wish for draft reform. The wired take is we need to change the contract structures where RFAs, being an RFA until you're, 27 or 7 years of NHL experience is preposterous.
Although it's already been demolished. The line between
RFA and UFA is... It's changing slowly, but it's still, I mean, you still...
I think it's changed rapidly.
Yeah. There's still players, though, that'll take way less than they're worth just to get that security, though.
For sure, for sure. But 10 years ago, the vets were the highest paid guys on every team, and now it's 21-year-olds who are the highest paid guys on every team with significant repercussions in terms of the internal dynamics in teams all around the league.
Yeah, which is the way it should be. You should be compensated fairly for your most productive seasons, which happen to be from, like, 21 to 25.
I mean, I'd love to just have a bonus pool and no draft.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's my personal view of it. Anyway.
Okay, part of this question was realistically implemented.
Well, the gold system is good. I don't see anything changing, though. And I thought it was really disappointing when the league moved from 3 to 2, right? You know, I get that the Devils and the Rangers just kept winning the lottery and teams overreacted to it. You know, everyone felt bad for Steve Yzerman, I guess. But, you know, the league with the three lotteries to determine all three picks meant that being the worst only guaranteed you fourth. It was still worth doing, by the way. It was still worth being last to guarantee yourself no worse than the fourth overall pick. But they've sort of created a system now where, you know, failure is rewarded even more gloriously than it has been for the last 5 years. Teams weren't tanking before. We actually are seeing a few teams tank this year. Maybe that's the quality of the draft itself. I probably is more than anything else, but I also think the league did create an environment where tanking was actually further incentivized when they reduced the number of draft lottery slots. I hated that. You know, I would even expand the odds. Like, I think the more random you can make the top of the draft, or if you're not going to connect it to winning something, the better it is.
Yeah. Okay. We need to move on. We're 15 minutes in, one question.
Yeah.
19 tabs. Hopefully you can close a few of them.
Never. I'm going to die as I lived, buried under a mountain of tabs.
All right. Mark does here. This could be a quick one for us, but I thought it was good because I think sometimes I make the mistake on this podcast of just like assuming that everyone is on the same page about everything. And in reality, right. There's a lot of people who might be new listeners who might be like, oh, interested in learning about this stuff, but might not necessarily have a full grasp on it. So Mark does here asks, can you explain goaltending stats? I often hear things like both goalies have an 880 save percentage, so their goaltending is bad. But at the same time, you also hear, oh, his save percentage is low, but look at the team in front of him. So how can both those things be true?
I mean, the fact is that we're not good at yet, right?
We're really bad at it, yeah.
Save percentage with the team.
Well, we're bad at measuring defense.
And we're bad at measuring
goalies. And
we're
even worse at measuring responsibility for keeping the puck out of your own net, I guess is the best way to put it.
For sure. We're just bad at measuring defensive contributions or puck or goal prevention contributions sort of across the board.
Yep.
I still like save percentage better than wins and losses and stuff. And I definitely like it more than goals saved above average.
Yes.
Which is a stat I'm increasingly dubious of, though I used to use it.
Throw it out.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I'm watching Thatcher Demko a lot, obviously, and... You know, he's not playing well, but he's also not playing 870 goaltender. Like, he's not an 870 goaltender based on the chances and the way this team is getting seamed. Like, if you get seamed twice right off a faceoff for a backdoor tap-in, I'm sorry, that's not on you. It's not on you. Fans in this market right now are trying to blame him because he, like, made the first save on a screened shot only for a completely not boxed out forward to have a tap-in off the rebound. Like, I'm sorry, if the puck changes direction and it's screened... All you can ask is a guy to make the first save. Anyway, whatever. And then I see the goal saved above average numbers, and I'm so dubious of them because I think Demko's performed about as well as anyone could behind the team he's played against.
Right.
Or played behind. I see these examples every year, and, you know, yeah, he hasn't been superhuman, but he'd have to be superhuman, and even if he, you know, was, what, 910, I bet you he'd only be like zero. Goal saved above average, considering the chances that are being surrendered are so dangerous because of a puck movement thing, and these numbers are just tracking location.
Yes, yeah, that's you hit the nail on the head there. I think goal save above expected is significantly better than save percentage because at least it's trying to account for the environment and where the shots are coming from. Now, Demko has given up 32 goals in 8 games. He's the prime example for this. 880 save percentage. So this example, this question asked
literally
when you reference
Demko,
an 880 save percentage, literally Demko. He also has a league worst negative 8.5 goals save above expected, according to Evolving Hockey. I talked about this with Woodley yesterday, so I don't necessarily want to do a whole thing on it. Please just go listen to that conversation.
Yeah.
But I watched back all 32 goals. I'd say 4 of them were shots that he should have
like
had.
Like Ovechkin one, like a few others.
He had, I think 4, maybe 5.
Yeah.
The rest were all either a blown assignment in front of the net where a stick didn't get tied up, a breakaway, a tip, or like backdoor cross seam where he had to move laterally and had no chance.
And there's been a lot of those shorthanded.
Really bad. Oh, and he has a 914 5-on-5 save percentage, which isn't great, but it's kind of middle of the pack, not 880 overall. And he's playing behind the league worst penalty kill. So,
how about the Devils having a 900 save percentage and still being 8-3?
Yeah.
How funny is that?
How much did you enjoy watching a fun, exciting, fast, young team?
Well, they do so much cool stuff.
Yeah.
They just do so much cool stuff. And when you
and
get
that
to
was,
watch
that was one
live,
of their worst games they play this year, too.
Oh, by far their worst game.
Yeah.
By far. Certainly the first period was their worst period of the year. Not close.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the way that they use like forwards in the high slot on exits, just some of the cool spin passes into space down ice, knowing that they're the fastest show on ice and can just beat people to pucks. A ton of fun. In that Edmonton game, I kept an eye on it even as I was at the Canucks game watching that, Canucks Ducks contest last
scrimmage
night. Game of it was fire wagon hockey in the second half. I'm not gonna. It was fun in the building, but yeah, I was keeping an eye on that. Thrilling, just a thrilling game of hockey.
Yeah, we had another question in here about which team we're most high on moving forward from, like, I think it was like the Red Wings, the Sabres, and the Senators or someone else.
Sorry, so the Red Wings?
It was like young teams who like
the Senators
have like made recent moves / have shown promise, right? And we could like lump, I mean, I think the Devils have sort of
leapfrogged those teams
and gone past that.
And maybe Buffalo.
But I see before the season, I think we would have had the Ducks there, not necessarily for this season's expectations, but in terms of like, we were super high on them in the Watchability podcast.
Sure.
And we were like, I'd like to see them take another step here towards competency. They look like a team where the 18 skaters just got together on a Thursday night for an hour to get away from their families
and have a beer after the
game.
Yeah, it's bad.
Maybe watch the Thursday nighter after. And like, do they practice?
You know what? I've never seen. I've never seen this before, until last night. I've never seen so many players bunched together away from the puck.
Yeah.
Like, they are literally standing next to each other. There is no sense of shape or discipline in the way that they're playing. It is wild.
It kind of reminds me a bit of when things really went off the rails for the Patrick Roy Avalanche, or even maybe the Jeremy Colladin Blackhawks.
Yeah.
Okay. Where the personnel is bad in terms of, like, compared, like, they're not a contender by any means.
Yeah, but they're also
disorganized. But they should be much more organized. It looks like they're almost unprepared.
Yeah, I wouldn't put the... Would you put the Blackhawks in that category?
No, not this year's. I mean, like, there was 2 years ago or whatever where defensively they were like, how does this keep happening?
I know. The Blackhawks just played such weird hockey, though.
Yeah.
You know, and it was... I do think they were just, like, catering to Patrick Kane. Like, they did these five-man breakouts from behind the net, like... Might as well have been deploying the flying V in a real NHL game.
I know.
They played roller hockey.
Yeah. It's disappointing, though, because heading into the year, I think you and I were really high on the Ducks, the Sabres, and the Devils. Now, two out of three is not bad,
especially when you're picking dark horses. But yes. I thought the Ducks would be able to move north-south.
Yeah.
No. They can't move at all. And they can't defend. They were bunched up. I was honestly blown away. I was blown away by the defensive coverage, and I was hearing from people in the league watching the game, and they were just like, this is atrocious, appalling. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I have higher hopes for them than that.
Me too.
All right, let's do another quick one here then before we go. Actually, no, we'll start it, and then it'll be a great, as we go into break, then we'll be like, come back for more of this.
Let's go. Radio pros.
Players we love for no good reason.
Oh,
now,
boy.
Your mileage on no good reason can vary. Like, I don't think we should say, like, guys who are clearly stars because it's like, we like them because they're really good. It's like, no, there should be guys that it's like a niche sort of take where...
Like Nick Blankenberg.
Sure.
Nick Blankenberg is at the top of my list.
Okay.
Because he's a 5'9" guy who can skate, move the puck, and hits everything. What's not to love?
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get into more Will Borgen talk on the other side.
Okay, let me give you a quick one.
Okay.
Logan O'Connor. So I love Logan O'Connor.
I kind
of did this
too.
Podcast last year. I'm going to regurgitate a few of the guys I did, but they still apply, so I just can't move off of Logan O'Connor. Every once in a while when I'm watching an Avs game, I like look away from my screen, and then I look back, and I see someone moving up the ice incredibly quickly, and it looks like their number is 20-something. And I'm like, oh, there's Nathan MacKinnon. And then they do something that's not very skilled with the puck.
Right.
And then I'm like, oh, no, that was Logan O'Connor. I love him because he has one gear and it is maximum speed. He plays at all times like that. There's no shifting of gears, no throwing curveballs, changeup slowing down. Nope. He just goes as fast as he can. He's really fun to watch on the penalty kill where he's like, he's legitimately more dangerous on the penalty kill than a 5-on-5. If he had finishing ability, he'd be so good, but he also wouldn't cost the Avs $1 million or 1.05 or whatever he does.
For sure.
So he's like a nice utility piece for them, but I just really enjoy him because he's really fun to watch, and he fits this example of guys you love for no good reason. Because I remember last year I posted like a mixtape of him with having penalty kill breakaways or something, and people were like, who is this guy, and like what's going on here, and they were like amazed that he had like 12 breakaways on the penalty kill last year.
Sick. He's got that Michael Grabner gene.
But I have a soft spot for guys like that. I know the finishing's never going to come around. But 1 year, what if he does shoot 15%?
Well, the thing is if you hang around long enough...
It'll happen.
You will. You'll have at least one, you know, Grabner scored 36, Yannick Hansen scored 22. Like, that player type does go off.
Yeah. All right, Tom. I can't wait to hear more about Will Borgen. But this is a good spot for us to take a break. When we come back, we're going to keep rattling through as many of our listener questions as we can. You're listening to the Friday Mailbag edition of the Hockey PDOcast here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here on the Hockey PDOcast. Dmitry Filipovich, joined by Thomas Durantz. We're doing mailbag questions. Tom, we're going to keep going with our list of players that we like
for no reason. Yeah. Well, I was going to say Will Borgen, but most listeners on Vancouver Radio have heard me do that, so I'm going to pick...
They're like, enough of this guy.
I'm going to pick a different Seattle Kraken player.
Okay.
Daniel Sprong.
Oh, I love Daniel Sprong.
Daniel Sprong. Here's what I like about Daniel Sprong. In a lot of ways, he profiles... as a, like a classic perimeter shooter, yeah. right? He's got the shot velocity. The mechanics are sick. When he's on the flanks on the power play, it's always a ton of fun to watch him tee up. But he's massive. Like, he's massive, and he's such a smooth skater. It's almost like what I was hoping. Do you remember Teemu Pulkkinen?
Mm-hmm.
I used to have high hopes for Teemu Pulkkinen. It's like what I always wanted out of Teemu Pulkkinen, Daniel Sprong.
The ultimate 4A player.
He's the ultimate 4A player.
I think Sprong's better than that, though. Like, Sprong's a legit NHLer.
Sprong's right. become the NHL version. Yes. I actually think Sprong's good. Like, I think Sprong can help you win.
Yeah.
Can help a good team win. But it's just this combination. He's got all of the skills that I almost associate with smaller guys. But he's just massive,
yep.
and he's so slick on his skates. I just always have a ton of fun watching him.
He's the ultimate heat check player.
He is the ultimate heat check
player. Yeah, like if you catch him on the right night, he'll like snipe two goals, and you'll be like, this guy's in the race for the Rocket, right?
He's NHL skipped my
loop. Then you're like, he has 12 goals?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had this classic moment when he was on the Capitals where he was coming down in a two-on-one. He had the puck on the left flank, I believe. Ovechkin was on the other side. He looks off Ovechkin. Beats the goalie cleanly and then like has like this like evil smile after as if like there was any doubt that I was going to keep this and score.
That's amazing.
So yeah, I love Daniel Sprong. I think that's a great call, and I'm actually surprised that he was as available this offseason as you like. Literally anyone could have had him for free,
and he's he'd help a lot of teams.
Yeah, because it's hard to score goals, especially if 5-on-5, and he can do that,
especially when you've got like your plus skater with size,
yeah.
and then you also have special teams utility, like plus special teams utility. You can build a whole second unit around that shot.
Yeah,
that might not be better than average, but that's useful.
I like Sprong. That's a good one. I'll give you the next on my list, Connor Clifton.
Connor Clifton.
Did I snake you?
No, he's you know what? I hadn't actually considered him, but he's like one of my long term guys.
Well, let me give you my case.
Okay.
This year, he's playing 17 minutes at 5-on-5, 21-30 overall with McAvoy out, and now Forbert's out as well. He's playing, I think he's second on the Bruins behind Hampus Lindholm in usage.
Yeah.
At the time of the expansion draft, I remember talking him up as like, this is like no-brainer pick for Seattle. And they took Jeremy Lozon instead, who they wound up turning into a top 50 overall pick
yeah.
from Nashville, so I guess it worked out.
I actually
in that sense.
Don't hate Lozon.
I think Clifton's just a significantly superior hockey player.
He had Seattle's Nate Schmidt potential.
But here's the thing. At the time, he was a 26-year-old, right-shot defenseman, making $1 million a year for two more years.
I think he might be a lefty who plays right.
I think he shoots right and he plays both sides.
Got it.
In
my head, he's
a... I think he's like literally a right shot in terms of he shoots right, but I think they've used him more on
Oh,
the
you're
left.
Right. He is a right shot.
But he's playing on the right now with Lindholm.
Okay. Anyway, it's inexcusable that they took Lozon.
This is why he's my pick. He's listed at 5'11", I believe. I think that might even be a bit generous. He's probably like 5'10 or something. If he was 6'2", without changing his game or his results. So I'm not like, this is literally if you just stretched him up vertically, NHL GMs would be falling all over themselves to get this guy, to sign him to a mega deal, to like feature him atop their depth chart. And because he's 5'11", people have talked themselves into him being like an undersized guy.
He's a tweener.
He is nasty.
Yeah, he's good.
In terms of like physicality. Like he throws the body, he will hit you hard. And he'll drop the glove. Like he'll do everything, except he's short, so people are like, he's not that type of player. And I just don't get it.
What's amazing, I was so high on him leading up to the expansion draft, and then he wasn't very good last year.
Yeah.
And now this year I'm watching him play. I'm watching that whole Bruins team play. Like, going into the season, I had a big Bruins fade going, aged poorly. And largely it was like, I'm not sure about their defense. I like Carlo. I don't love Carlo, right? I love Greslick. I love McAvoy, but he's going to be out.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much Lindholm has in the tank, right? And now Lindholm is dominant.
Yeah.
Having a dominant season. And Connor Clifton's back to doing what I expected him to do last year. And now, once McAvoy gets back, that team's going to be cooking with oil. I mean, they could very well win that division. And I would never have thought that was realistic. Are we into the underrated puck-moving D part of the list?
Of course.
Should I give you Mikey Anderson or should I give you Nick Jensen?
I'm
going to give you Nick Jensen. Because Mikey Anderson's more obvious.
See, I would pick Martin Ferravari on that same blue line.
Oh yeah, see, I'm a Jensen
okay.
guy.
Okay, so give me your take.
Farivari is awesome too. Jensen is the perfect second pair defenseman, right? I just, in my mind's eye, what do I want from a second pair defenseman? I want a guy who can make some plays with his feet, but doesn't try to make too many plays with his feet. I want him to play within himself. I want him to be reliable defensively. I want him to be able to be physical, but I want him to be able to key the transition game. Nick Jensen is just like the perfect, like, holding mid style hockey player. He just controls games. He doesn't try to do too much. He knows his limitations. He gets the puck moving in the right direction consistently. He is, for me, especially in combination with Orlov, right? They are the infrastructure that keeps the Capitals from succumbing to the gravity that they so obviously should be succumbing to based on the age and like lack of foot speed and lack of dynamism in their forward group, particularly with both Backstrom and Tom Wilson out. Like, I'm watching this Caps team right now, and I'm like, these guys aren't even good. And then they throw their second pair on, and it's like, oh, wow, they outshot the opposition 12-5 in those minutes, and they won a game by one goal.
Yeah.
And it's not a coincidence. Like, Nick, you can build meaningful infrastructure around Nick Jensen. He's like, it's like having a really good left tackle in football. It just opens up all of this stuff and makes everyone look a little bit better than they are. Nick Jensen's like the perfect player to do that.
Well, it's funny that you brought up Mikey Anderson, and then that's what led me to thinking about Martin Farivari, because I tracked every single playoff game that happened last year and last year's postseason. And they were like the two big standouts for me of guys that I hadn't really appreciated enough before from just kind of more casual viewings and just seeing them actually play game after game after game and tracking their individual contributions. So good defensively, especially in the neutral zone, like an ability to just stick with puck carriers, which is such an important skill in today's game and such a tough one to find.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not necessarily like elite skaters, especially like we think of elite skaters as guys with the puck that can move up the ice, but we don't necessarily think of like backtracking, and those guys can do it so well without necessarily taking a lot of penalties. And so I like Mike Anderson is a great call as well.
Well, and this comes back to our lack of appreciation for goal prevention. You know, there's something in soccer where a guy like Xavi can like never have a touch in the box their entire career, but everyone knows that they're a metronome, you know, and for whatever reason, the transitional puck mover who's never going to get PP one time, probably never even going to get PP two time, maybe they don't have the most dynamic shot, you know, can go an entire career being underappreciated. I mean, before the injuries caught up to Danny DeKeyser, right, he was in that mold. Chris Tanev's, to me, like the standout of a guy who's played his whole career just being like just eating tough minutes for breakfast and has never even like, it, you know, up until he basically went to Calgary, it was like controversial to call him a first pair defender. He's been a first pair defender for a decade.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it sort of speaks to our awareness of it. Like there's this player type. Anderson's a good example. I think Jensen's a good example. These guys aren't, I don't think, appreciated for just how big an influence they can have on where the game is played as like signal callers effectively at 5-on-5.
For a while there before he lost the foot speed mark, Edward Vlasic.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Except Vlasic somehow got the attention.
He did, and he got the contract as well.
Vlasic and Girardi were like the only players of this ilk that got the attention.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but that's just how it played out.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, I'll give you one last one here. I'll give you the floor for it, because we both wanted to talk about this guy, and he actually kind of ties into a question that we got from another listener as well. So I think this guy has transcended this group based on his start this season.
Okay. So, sorry, you want one more before you go to him?
No, I want you to go to him right now.
Oh, okay. Can I just shout out one more guy?
All right, fine.
I need to shout out one more guy. Okay. I need to... Blake Lizotte.
Yeah?
I just got to shout out Blake Lizotte. He's awesome.
I think it was like game four of last year's first round series against the Oilers. If you go back and watch that one, I don't know why anyone in their right mind would do that. But if you're feeling up for it, he played like 15 minutes or something, and he had like 15 shot contributions. Like he was like literally everywhere. He had a Connor McDavid-ish game.
Jeez.
In limited usage. So
Blake Lizotte, by the way, rocking devastatingly low percentages across the board.
Yeah, the Kings were pretty smart though.
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm not saying it's a buy low for an NHL team so much as it's a buy low for anyone with a really like playing in a 16 team fantasy league. Lizotte's gonna be much more productive in, over the balance.
In a Kings only fantasy league.
Yeah, a 16-team Kings only fantasy league.
All right, let's do Marty Natchez.
Yeah, Natchez. Natchez is the smoothest guy with the puck in the league.
Yeah.
It's just so sick to watch. His puck skills are outrageous. And we, you know, it's like they have to hibernate because the Hurricanes are players. I'm pretty sure Hurricanes players are contractually obligated to never transition a single zone with control ever, right? You punt everything, you dump everything. And so we don't often see Natchez's sort of just natural affinity and slickness come to the fore, but you see it in hints and starts, and when you do, it's so exciting. Just limitless potential. I'd love to see him play on a puck possession team that really just trusts him full time as a centerman. I think it would be one of the most fun. He'd be must watch for me in that type of position. On the Hurricanes, still good, having a great start to the season, crushing it. Love to see him get more responsibility there, but ultimately, you know, I still think we're only seeing like 75% of the Marty Natchez experiment or experience, because as a center on a team that emphasizes control, I think it'd be lights out.
Well, let me give you some stats on him this year, because I was actually surprised to see this. At 5-on-5, last year he played 12.28 per game, which was eighth amongst Canes forwards. He leads the team in 5-on-5 usage this year.
Unleashed, let's go.
Playing 19.52 overall, which also leads the Canes in terms of forward usage. Him, Svechnikov, and Kotkaniemi has been their best line.
Yeah.
Like, I love Aho and Jarvis, but they've been their most consistent all year in the first 10 games.
I actually have really come to like watching Jesperi Kotkaniemi this year, too. He's been really good. I still think, though, in another system, you'd want Kotkaniemi as the winger so that he could do the weird stuff he does with his range and along the wall as the F1 more.
Yeah.
And you could have
Natchez is the center.
He is?
Like he needs to, well, no, but he, like...
He is the center is the, like, with the puck.
He needs to be in the middle of the ice. Yeah.
He needs... Yeah, I'm just saying, I want him to be the brain of that line, you know, and I want Kotkaniemi to be doing Valeri Nichushkin stuff with his range and speed.
Yeah.
And just a battle-winning ability. His raw battle-winning ability this season has been standout every time I've watched the Canes play.
Yep. I'm with you there. I love Marty Natchez. Okay. Let's do another listener question here. So I actually got one. It was... from Matthew Hames here, asks, favorite defensive D-man, quote-unquote, who isn't very tall or big? I think we kind of answered that with, like, Mikey Anderson, Martin Fairbairn.
Yeah, yeah.
Connor Clifton. Let's keep going here. Do you want to do a bit about Erik Karlsson? I got a few Erik Karlsson questions, people just wanting us to talk about him.
Sure. The Sharks.
Well,
they're a team. No, Erik Karlsson's off to an incredible start.
He scored 32 goals this season. He has 10 of them. And he's been on the ice for 24 of the 32.
Unreal.
I just wanted to give Erik Karlsson some love. It's great. It's great to see him.
I love to
see him. He's moving so well. Like, he actually legitimately looks healthy. I think...
Someone's going to get him at 50% retained, right?
Here's the thing. No, I don't think so. I think... Well, not yet. It's too much. I think maybe we underrate, like, for these pro athletes, how much being healthy in the offseason might matter in terms of, like, coming into the season not already nursing stuff. Like, I think John Tavares is another great example of this, where I thought looked quite horrible physically last year. Like, he was still effective down low and kind of like doing stuff.
The classic JT area.
But watching him move around the puck or try to do anything in space was painful.
Yeah, cement boots.
And now all of a sudden, not that he's a burner, but like, he's actually moving around and it opens up so many different plays for him when he's not just relying on like posting up. Or like doing the hockey equivalent of pushing up, right? Like, he can actually step outside. And so I think a similar thing going on with Karlsson there, where I imagine he had a pretty good offseason in terms of training and feeling good about himself physically, and that's translated.
Kevin Bieksa was talking about his career and his relationship with the Canucks fans yesterday when he was at Rogers Arena to retire as a Canucks player. And he was like, you know, I had a good start to my career, then I got injured, then I got grinded down as I returned back from it, and then I got injured again, and the criticism started. And, you know, I think you're right. I think an awful lot of what we see as, you know, players declining performances is so often injury related. And honestly, that's one of the prime ways that I use Corsi 4 in particular to track player health. Like, when I see a really good player's numbers just fall off, especially when they're a centerman.
Yep.
And I haven't like noticed that they're hurt. It's always a tell for me. It's always a tell. And you know, back, something like that, right? Like something that they're managing. I always track it in part because I want to know. I want to know for the team that I cover, the Canucks, like I want to know quickly if a guy's fallen off a map and why. And if I should be carving them for their performance or if I should be...
Well, it also sucks because I think we, and unfortunately so, like really lionize players who play through pain.
Totally.
And there's different forms of it, right? If it's like something that like won't impact your quality of life after retirement or like can't get significantly worse physically. Yeah. If it's like something where it's like
a pain management,
you know,
issue.
What? I can like, I'm not feeling my best, but I can still contribute. I understand that, especially in the postseason when it's like something potentially dangerous. I think we should like fully stop celebrating that. And
I
it should be like, you need to take care of your body. Yeah. But at the same time, then if a player plays through pain, but we're not necessarily privy to it, because obviously it doesn't behoove them to tell everyone, hey, no.
You only find out about it if they're eliminated.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like, oh, I had 14 different surgeries.
Right. And I never want to be like, man, this guy's really letting down the team. And then it's like after the team's eliminated, they're like, he played with a punctured rib. And it's like, oh my goodness, punctured rib. But you know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking about a broken rib that could puncture your lung, a la Patrice Bergeron.
Right.
That's literally the injury in my head. So, you know, it's honestly one of my main usages of shot attempt differential, because I have this memory in my head of Henrik Sedin, one Henrik Sedin season, his back was flaring up, and it just, like, dropped off a cliff. Like, all of a sudden, the Twins' usual game just disappeared. And, team starts losing, everyone's criticizing the Twins, and it's just like, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of work going on just to get him on the ice for morning skate.
Yep.
So, anyway.
Yep, I'm with you. Tyson Monroe asks, do the Oilers need to upgrade righty or lefty first?
Ooh.
Do you want me to give you my take?
Yeah, go.
I think they actually need to upgrade their left side by subtracting Tyson Barry from the right side.
Yeah.
It just allocating $4.5 million in cap space to what they're getting out of him and the way they're using him as such like a luxury item on the power play when
they've
Evan Bouchard there would be totally fine.
Totally fine.
Or it really doesn't matter who's physically standing at the blue line because you have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. It makes no sense to me to have that. I'd like to see them improve the left side. Like Brett Kulak, who I love and had an awesome postseason.
Struggling.
Has struggled this year. He's made some mistakes.
He'll bounce back.
Well, it's funny. If you look at the numbers, like he actually revived Barry last year when he came and they paired him up together and he kind of did everything for that pairing and allowed Barry to play to his capabilities. This year, they like were getting hammered. And then they put him with Bouchard and the numbers
stabilized.
Are fine again.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I right now their left side's Nurse, Kulak, Niemelainen. I'd like to see them add like a second pairing-ish lefty, especially because realistically in today's NHL, you probably have to pay less in terms of assets to get a competent lefty. As opposed to paying a premium for a righty when I think CeCe and Bouchard atop the right side are totally fine. So paying 4.5 for a third pair right shot Tyson Barry just makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still of the opinion that the Edmonton Oilers are the team that should go hunt and trade for Seth Jones. That's my hottest take. That's what the Oilers should be doing. Here's my thing. The Oilers should just go get the best defenseman they can possibly get.
Yeah.
You just need another difference maker there and then figure it out. That's my view. I just think the Oilers need one more big piece on the blue line.
I don't think they should be investing significant resources in that piece.
I think they should. I think you have 4 years right here. This is it. And you have to win with McDavid and Draisaitl in their primes. You have to. It would be so embarrassing to not turn this stretch of hockey dominance into a Stanley Cup.
Of course.
And I just think the thing they need is a really good defenseman who can log huge minutes.
Yeah.
That would be the one thing I'd get. Now that they've overpaid on a goalie, that would be the one thing I'd go get.
Yeah.
Okay. I've really upset you.
We don't have,
I've really upset you here.
We don't have enough time on today's episode of the PDOcast for me to fully unpack that one. Maybe next time we have you on, we'll do a full episode on that take. I'm going through the questions here. I feel like we've actually done a really good job of answering a lot of these. A lot of people really came through. Bert Morrison asks, is John Marino, a.k.a. Johnny Marinaro, in the Norris conversation?
No. No, he's not playing enough, right? Like, I watched that game.
I mean,
game.
We don't need to talk about awards 10 games through the season.
No, but also, I watched that game the other day.
He's so good, though.
He's so good. No, he's brought such a huge dynamic to that team. But I watched the game the other day that he played in Vancouver. I watched it live. He was great. And then at the end of the game, I check the time on ice, and it's like, oh, he played the fifth most minutes on their team, 5-on-5.
I know.
You know, like, and that's not inconsistent.
It's not a hallmark of a...
No, you know, I mean, he's playing a few more seconds per game than Jonas Siegenthaler, right? He's second on the team in 5-on-5 ice time, but it's like game dependent. He's not always. So, you know, I don't know if his usage is significant enough. Like, I don't see the case for that if you're not really the 1A defenseman on your own team. You know, like, how do you win the Norris when you're not the 1A on your own team?
Well, I think. I can't argue with the numbers in terms of the usage. I will say, like, the past couple home games we saw, I did a whole deep dive on this with Cam Chiron, our pal Cam. Their final, or the last couple home games before they came out on the road here at West, Lindy Ruff, like, hard matched him against McKinnon's line and then Goodrow's line in those two matchups against the Avs and the Blue Jackets, and he did great, and he, like,
ate their lunch,
was just a blanket.
Yeah.
And I think that's how they want to use him. I think they're, like, so confident in terms of their depth throughout their defensive blue line that they're just rolling those three lines, and they're not really, like, obsessing over getting him out there as soon as the first line hops on. But, yeah, I mean, the impact, like, even in that Canucks game where it wasn't necessarily prolific, he had that stretch pass that led to the 2-on-1
goal.
He broke up a 2-on-1 defensively as well, like, made it look effortless. Like,
yeah,
some of the stuff he's subtly doing is, I got to do a mixtape on him soon.
He was incredible. He's really good. I just think you need to be a 1A on your team before I'm really taking your Norris case seriously. He's got 70 games to take those reins, right? But I need to see that. That's like, I can't vote you for Norris if you're not the 1A guy.
Yeah.
That's my view.
Yeah, that's fair.
But, you know, I'm also the guy who had Chris Tanev on his ballot, so.
number one PDOcast reply guy, Meeks, asks, you're given the green light to make a new jersey for any team, with the only directive that it has to be crazier than the one Tampa Bay just made for their retro reverse or whatever. Did you see that one?
Yeah.
They wore yesterday?
I hate it.
What do you do?
So I have to make a crazier jersey than the Tampa
Bay. I don't know if it's possible. They
lightning.
Literally just, like, had a kindergartner just throw a bunch of stuff up against a poster and then just rolled with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
And you know what? I was watching the game. I don't mind it.
Really?
I don't think it should be, like, their full-time jersey, but I think the NHL takes itself so seriously. And honestly, for a couple games a year, why not? Like, it's actually fun when you're watching as depraved amount of hockey as we do, and I'm flicking between games, and I'm like, oh, everything is just, like, it's getting so monotonous.
Yeah,
it's
all navy and red.
Yeah, it's actually really nice to just, like, oh, wow, that's kind of random.
Well, when the Dallas Stars, like, first adopted those, like, light green uniforms, it was, like, such a relief.
Yeah.
Especially because they were playing exciting hockey under Ruff then, right? Like, those were fun teams, in part because they looked fun. They looked like the Hulk on ice. Okay, I think I've always thought that we need to see a pink Florida Panthers jersey.
Yeah.
I think a pink Panthers jersey just makes so much sense. It's, like, so easy to sell, and you can do it in that, like, Miami Vice color scheme that the Heat have sort of made popular. Like, the red becomes pink, the blue becomes sky blue. Easy. Would be so sick. And you get to call it the Pink Panthers jersey.
That's pretty cool.
Everyone wants that, right?
Honestly, those Panthers ones, the baby blue ones now are
sick.
How have we not gotten
care
packages and, like, promoting it on Sportsnet 650 all the time?
I haven't inquired. I suppose I should do so.
I really hope you do, because I want one of those so bad. All right, Tom, that's all the time we've got today. I'll let you plug your show. Hopefully people enjoyed the banter
crossover
between us, because I'm on your show every, it's either
Thursday.
Wednesday or Thursday, but Thursdays.
Thursday, the PDO report on Canucks Talk, which airs on Sportsnet 650. And obviously I'm at The Athletic.
I love it. And at Thomas Trance on Twitter. You'll be back on the PDO cast again very soon. If you enjoyed listening to today's show, please smash that 5-star button and give us a nice review wherever you listen. So thank you for checking out the Hockey PDO cast on the Sportsnet Radio Network.